it did so. So, who does he meet here? Man. All right, and who is this guy with the sword?
I'm thinking Michael.
Yeah, don't.
I'm thinking it might be the Lord himself, Jesus Christ.
We know he's.
Yeah,
we know that he's the captain of the Lord of hosts, and we know that at the very least he is representing God and God's presence. And we know that because Joshua was told that where he is holy, and so that's basically the place where God was at this time. So we don't get like a super detailed picture of this guy. Basically, we hear that he's a guy standing with a sword drawn. But anytime we have a picture of anything representing God or anything representing the mighty angels or whatever he would be, what is that picture that we usually see? Like, how would you describe that?
See a being with a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I mean, usually those are very extreme pictures. There's something that stands out above just it being a regular guy. Now, it doesn't say that here, but I kind of wonder if he would have had some even more superior appearance.
Represents a battle, too, usually, or some kind of confrontation or battle that's coming about when you have a sword.
Yeah. So, I think the focus of this is on, again, giving Joshua more confidence. Showing him that, you know, this commander of... I guess most people would have said that Joshua was the commander of the army. That would have been kind of the general consensus. But he's told here that there is this other being, whatever it may be, or whomever it may be, that is truly the captain of the host of the Lord, or the armies of the Lord. So Joshua is given even kind of more reassurance or more affirmation that he's going to win this battle based on this warrior going in front of him. So what impresses me about Joshua is, what's Joshua's reaction to him? Like, what's the first thing Joshua does when he sees him?
Wants to know if he's for or against
him. Yeah, he goes up to him. He approaches him. And so I think most people would be kind of terrified or back away from this. But Joshua approaches this captain of the host of the Lord and basically challenges him, or at least questions, are you for us or against us? And I fully feel that Joshua was prepared to fight a battle if he needed to. I think he fully already trusted God that whoever this may be that was in front of him, that was in his way, he was ready, if he needed to fight that battle. I'd say he was probably not upset to find out that this guy was on his side. But we see... when Joshua hears who he is, he falls down, bows, it says he fell on his face to the earth and bowed down, and says, you know, what does the Lord say to his servant? So once he knows that he's on his side, he's ready to do whatever he's asked to do. And so what's he asked to do?
Take his shoes off, he's on holy ground.
Yeah, what does that remind us of? Moses. Moses, before he went in to handle the big tasks that he had to undertake, had a similar experience where there was this burning bush, and God through the bush told him, you know, take off your sandals, for where you are is holy ground. You're standing on holy ground. So again, just more confirmation to Joshua that God is with him, and that it's the time is now, basically. The time is now to start this conquest. So moving into chapter 6, verse 1 of chapter 6, again, I think, shows the feelings that have been building up to this point. It says, Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went out and no one came in. So what's the picture here? What do we see in Jericho? How are they feeling?
They're scared. They've shut up everything. Nobody's going about anything. They won't come out.
Yeah, I mean, they have entrenched themselves. They've gotten the most defensive position they can be in, to where they are all within the walls, all within what they would consider their protection, their best protection, because of the sons of Israel. And they'd just seen, I'm sure, this Jordan River open up and the people walk through it. pretty scary to know that these people are coming for you. They're coming after you. So God proceeds to kind of give Joshua a plan. What does God tell Joshua is going to happen? Yeah, I think verse 2, he leaves no doubt. I have given Jericho into your hands. Basically, it's already happened, or at least it's a foregone conclusion that this is going to happen. There's no doubt. And then he goes on to give Joshua the instructions of what Joshua needs to do, or what the people need to do to take over the city. And what are they supposed to do?
They're supposed to go around the city once for 6 days.
Mm-hmm. Go around seven times.
And then they shout.
And then they shout. So they've got kind of, it lists some different groups of people that are going around. So what are some of the groups that are in this this march?
Seven priests that are going to go before the ark.
Mm-hmm.
With trumpets.
Yep, so we've got seven priests that have the trumpets. We know that the ark is going. And who else is going? The big group. Who's the big group? Yeah, the army, the men of war, those prepared for war. I'm not, in reading through this, I couldn't determine for sure if it seems like all the people go or just the army. I kind of lead toward just the army, but I think it could go either way, because they're the only ones specified. And so it says, what's going to happen to the wall? What's going to happen to the wall? All right, it's going to fall or crumble or collapse.
Flat.
Yeah, fall flat. I mean, I kind of wonder if it's just like everything just crumbling and just almost like I would picture this in a cartoon would happen, the way that the wall's just going to almost disintegrate, just down to nothing. And so what are the people going to be able to do in verse 5 when the wall goes down? And how are they going to rush in? It specifically says something of how they're going to go in. What direction?
Straight.
Yeah, straight ahead. So the picture here is that when this wall comes down, everyone's going to be able to go straight ahead. So the picture is not that there's going to be like this little portion of the wall that falls and everyone's going to have to kind of funnel through there. We don't see that type of picture, but we see the wall is going to come down in such a way that everyone can pretty much just go forward. And so if you picture everybody outside of this circle, they're all going to kind of converge toward the middle. You know, again, leaving no doubt about what's happening here. There's not just some little breach in the wall, but it's going to be a huge event, just something that's unheard of, basically, something that's not going to just physically happen. So God gives Joshua the commands, and what does Joshua do?
Passes it along to the people of Israel.
Yeah, he tells the people what they need to know. And so verse 6, it says, he talks to the priests, and he tells them what they're going to do, which is take the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant, and then the seven priests with the trumpets. And then he tells the people, you know, this is what you're going to do. You're going to march around. The armed men are going to go before the Ark. And then there's a rear guard I'll talk about later. And then again, verse 8, and we talked about some of the things here in Joshua and really throughout the Bible repeat, you know, what's going to happen and then what happens. And verse 8 kind of sums that up. Sort of that, it says, and it was so. You know, what was said was going to happen is what happened. What they were told to do is what they did. So let's see, down in verse 10, Joshua gives a probably pretty challenging command to the people. What's he tell them in verse 10?
Not to make any sound with their voice.
Yeah, not even, no word proceed out of your mouth. Until when?
The day I bid you to shout.
All right. So the picture I get here is that this is before they've started, so they're making the plans. He tells them, you know, don't speak, don't make a word or a sound until that day. So it's not don't make a sound today until this happens, but until that day when I tell you to shout. I don't know how detailed he would have been with the people. I don't know if he specified to them that it's going to be this full 7-day plan, or if they just kind of took it one day at a time and he told them, all right, today this is what you do. And then the next day, today this is what you do. But they would have known it was a long plan. I think any time we think of a plan that lasts over 7 days, there's some preparation, and sometimes we can get a little restless. But I think God points out here that, you know, the people needed to be patient with him. How many of you could go 7 days without making a sound, without talking? I was going to say the same thing. Right. I mean, if I told you all, just the group of us right here, all right, let's get up and we're going to go walk a mile, and none of you are allowed to say anything. Could we do it? I'm not going to say we couldn't do it, but it would not be easy. It would not be our natural reaction. It would not be how we typically handled things. I'd say there'd probably be a word here or there, some little chit-chat back and forth. So this is 7 days of this, 7 days with the marching around the city. I thought about making everyone get up and march around here silently, but I didn't know how well that would be received. But we could try it sometime if you all wanted to. But they've got to be silent this whole time until he gives the command to shout. And what's going to happen when they shout? The walls are going to come down. There's some good songs based on this book and this event. Yep. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good image. Just destruction. It just goes away from something to nothing, basically. Yep. And when they finally got to the point where they were allowed to shout, was it a quiet shout? No. There was no reservation, I'm sure. If you bottle that in for even a half a minute or a minute, then when they're kind of given that release, you're going to see that explosion, basically, of the energy, and especially with kids, the excitement to finally get to shout, or with me, I would enjoy that as well. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't a big city.
Right.
It was, they estimate, about 600 people lived in it. So it wasn't a large city. You know, we think of a big.
Right.
I mean, to walk around a city like Mount Sterling, we'd be exhausted after one trip. It wasn't a big city. And from what I have read, there was a well in the city. And they brought all the food in, so they had plenty of supplies. Mm-hmm. They could last a long time in that city, and the people of the countryside would come in. Mm-hmm. And they found two walls around the city, they think. So that leads to kind of some speculation as to exactly what happened, the wall falling down and men able to march straight in. But I think that this is one of the things that validates what the scriptures teach, that men's explorations and exploring have found very plausible what the Bible says happened, and it just kind of reaffirms your faith. You know, someone like Don Bassett, who goes overseas and does those archaeological digs, I mean, they're fascinating what some of the things they have found that just confirm what the scriptures teach.
Yeah, there's been a lot It seems like over the last 100 years of kind of excavation in that area. The research I found, I think it was, they said about probably a little more than 6 acres. And I'm not exactly sure. I'd say that would be about a mile around. I could be off on that. I don't really know acres well. I should get Tom to help me out with my math here. Can you? But so it was enough that, or it was short enough that they could march around it 7 times in one day. It was long enough that the entire army was able to be around it. So that kind of gives a little bit of the idea. But yeah, it's we do see some of the history of it from archaeology. Yeah.
As they went around, because it wouldn't take that, you know, there was a large number of those people, so I mean they might be 8 or 10 abroad, yeah, going around, you know, that would be a real scary sight. I mean, that would bring some fear into you.
Yeah, I kind of wonder what the people in Jericho would have been thinking as this was going on, because you know they're terrified when they first come up and they march around and it probably feels like, okay, they're kind of circling us. And then they do that again, and then the next day they do it. And I kind of wonder if they're like, if they would have started to question, you know, what is going to happen. And I don't know if that would have made them more fearful or more kind of...
That's the techniques of war, though.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at some of our major wars, like Vietnam or the Gulf Wars, they would do these techniques to get into the minds, and, you know, the Lord's the best at it.
Yeah, just keep making you more anxious. That would have been interesting to, well, probably not very exciting, but it would have been interesting to see the perspective from the people inside Jericho. Verse 11, it talks, oh, they did this, and then verse 12, they're getting ready to do this again, or to go around the city. When do they start? When does Joshua start? Well, no, just what time does Joshua start making his rounds? Yeah, in the morning. Early. It says he rose early. I'm sure as soon as probably the light was up, he was ready to go. Just kind of, again, I think we see the idea through here that there was urgency in this. It wasn't, well, we're going to sit around and we'll have our morning coffee and read the paper and, you know, watch some TV before we go on and do this. But, you know, that was the point of their day. That was what they had to accomplish. And so they did not wait. They didn't wait or hesitate to do that. But Joshua, it seems like, is always, and we've seen that earlier in Joshua as well. I don't think I pointed it out, but it talks about Joshua early or rising early to do things. And again, on the seventh day, it's going to show that as well. Verse 15, I believe.
Was in the wall that separated the Israelites from them. Because if you look down across that many people marching around and know that you were going forward, you would try, if you didn't have some place to go and hide where they can't get to you, but you'd have to try to talk to them, try to reason or maybe try to barter your way out. So they put so much faith in that wall.
Yeah, they were definitely knew that they were up against something more powerful than they were, and I guess that was kind of their last hope, was fortify yourself in there and just hope you get lucky, basically. Hope that something crazy happens, but it did, just not in their favor. So it goes around, and they do this on the seventh day. They go around seven times. The priests blow the trumpets. Joshua tells the people to shout, and they shout. So once they get into the city, there are a few instructions. What are some of the instructions they had to follow when they entered the city?
All the iron, brass, and gold, and that stuff went to the Lord's treasury.
All right.
And take those spoils.
Yep. So.
That's what they're commanded.
Yeah.
And there was not to be any survival.
Yeah.
All to be put to.
They were to destroy everything, basically, except leave. Basically precious metals, not so that they could take them, but so that they could go to the treasury of the Lord. What was the one exception to destroying everything, or the other exception?
Rahab
and her family. And so it calls it, it says, the city shall be under the ban. So we'll start with that, and then we'll go into Rahab in the second part. But in their destruction, in the city being under the ban, what was that about? Why would they not take anything? If you were in regular warfare and you've conquered a city, what are you going to do with the spoils?
You take it.
You enjoy it. So they weren't supposed to do that. Why not? All right. And again, this may be a little bit of speculation, but I think it fits with the pattern of what God has done with Israel. Why did he want them to do this? Why did he want them to destroy everything and not take the spoil? What would that have done for them?
We still want to be dependent on him to supply their needs and take care of them and not use those spoils to sustain them.
Yeah. What did they actually do with the spoils? Or with the city, even? They burned it. Which is reminiscent of what that took place in the Old Testament. Yeah, the offerings, the burnt offerings, the sacrifices. In some ways I see this as like the first fruits, you know, the first fruits of your labor that were to go to God. This was the first fruits of their spoils or of their successes in war. And so they were to give that to God. And again, for a couple reasons, but I think just so that they trust in him. Because if someone gives you a lot of money, and then they say, I want you to give all that away. And so give everything you have away so that you have nothing left. Whether or not you give it all away would depend on how much you trusted that person would take care of you, would give you more after you did that. He'd promised to them, you're going to get all the things that you need. So, you know, the first instinct is, well, I need to save some of this at least. I need to save a little bit for me just in case. But he wanted them, again, to be fully trusting in him, fully dependent on him to know that he was the one who was going to provide. And he wants us to have that same appreciation for him, that same trust in him. And again, we can get so caught up in trusting the things that we have or where we are or our situation or whatever it may be. And I think probably money or wealth is maybe the main thing that people will trust in. And he wants us to recognize that what we have is from him. We don't need to put our trust in money or wealth or anything like that, just like he didn't want them to. So hopefully we can kind of follow that example. How well did they follow that command? Yeah, and we'll get into the details of it later, but if you go into verse 1 of chapter 7, it says, the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban, for Achan the son of Carmi, the son of Zubdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. Therefore the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. And we'll get into the details of that next week, but we just see one person really messed it up for everybody. Did not show that trust. He took some of the things that he was not lawfully allowed to have. So that's discussing the ban. So what happened with Rahab? What was the situation with Rahab?
So she was promised that she would not be hurt,
And was she?
No, she was
not. So who was sent to get her? The spies who had gone into her house earlier. What I think, one thing that's interesting here is when we think about the walls that were collapsed, how much of the walls came down?
Oh, except for the probably the part of her house, because we do know from earlier experience that her house, the backside of it was part of the wall.
Yeah, it doesn't specify that, but that's kind of the picture I get, that this entire wall, 99% of it came crumbling down, but this one, I just see this one little section where she lived was protected. Yeah, in the same way that, you know, God passed over the houses that had the blood on the doorposts, I get the picture that God passed over this little section of the wall that had the scarlet cord, that was where she was. So, you know, if it wasn't miraculous enough that the wall just all came down, just having likely this little piece of it left is even more so. The one spot where someone was commanded to hang the cord, because I don't think that cord was holding up a wall, but God allowed it to stay up because of that. So after this, after leaving, or after this destruction and Rahab saved, what does Rahab do? Yeah, she stays with them. She becomes one of them, basically. And again, I think there's a good picture here, or a good point, that how often, you know, we see people, and we may even do it ourselves, we respect who God is. You know, people say, well, yeah, I'm sure God is there and God is powerful. They recognize it the way that she recognized it, but then they just kind of go about doing their own thing, and they don't want to